Good evening, and welcome to what I believe is our fourth annual Haggadah night at Shaarei Shamayim. The evening is dedicated by Raquel and Jason Goldberg in memory of their daughter Tamima, alayha shalom. The program for the evening is hopefully familiar to quite a few of you. We have four Seder-ready Torah thoughts. The speakers have been instructed multiple times that the remarks are to be 10 minutes or shorter. The goal is to give you something which you can use at your Seder table. The speakers will present in the order in which their thoughts appear in the Haggadah. Adam Friedman will be first, then Rabbi Ziering, then Rabbi Jesse Shore, and then I will be the last one. There are source sheets, as I mentioned before, on the back table in both corners. There are also sign-in sheets. I'll mention again, since not everybody was here when I made the initial announcement, if you sign in, then, God willing, we will send you an email tomorrow with the link to the recording online from tonight's program, as well as the recording from last night's program and the source sheets, as well as a reminder next year for Haggadah night in Yerushalayim. So please make sure that you sign in, and I will ask Adam Friedman to please start us off.
Okay, good evening. I will be using the source sheet entitled The Function of Manishtana. I want to talk a little bit about Manishtana. And the question that I want to ask, so we know that these are the questions that the children ask at the Seder, but it seems that the Manishtana is more than that, perhaps. Perhaps part of the formal text of the Seder, that's what I want to deal with. What exactly is the purpose of it? What is the function of Manishtana at a Seder? If we look in the first source, the Mishnah describes the course of the Seder, the things that you're supposed to do, and it says that you get to the second cup, we make Kiddush on the first cup, we end up drinking it, we pour the second cup for the leader of the Seder. V'kan haben shu'al, here the son asks. The son asks his father questions about the difference between fast Passover night and other nights. If the son doesn't have the intelligence to ask, he's not developed enough to ask questions, then the father teaches him, and then the Mishnah goes on to list the questions of the Manishtana, the four questions that we have. They were a little bit different in the times of the Mishnah than they are today. So it's a little bit ambiguous. Is the Manishtana sort of fill-in text? If you have a child who doesn't know, doesn't have questions of his or her own to ask, then the Manishtana is to fill in. Or is it something more formal? The first source, the end of the first source, the Babylonian Talmud, says that you have to say the Manishtana even in circumstances where there are no children. If a person has no children, then one's wife maybe will ask. If there's nobody there, if a person is, for whatever reason, making a Seder alone, they have to ask themselves the questions. They must recite Manishtana. And it very much sounds like Manishtana is a formal part of the text of the Haggadah. We have to say it no matter the circumstances. Okay, that's the Babylonian Talmud. On the other hand, we have the Jerusalem Talmud. Jerusalem Talmud in the second source is also commenting on our same Mishnah. And the Jerusalem Talmud introduces another feature which we're familiar with from the Seder of the four sons, the wise son, the wicked son, the foolish son, the son who cannot ask. And the Talmud there describes the different questions of the different sons, what will they ask, and the way that you're supposed to answer them. And then at the end, it says, this is the last couple of lines, in source number two, the son who does not know how to ask, you must begin for him. You need to ask for him. And Rabbi Yossi said, this is exactly what the Mishnah meant. When the Mishnah said that if you have a son who doesn't know how to ask, you have to ask for him, you have to teach him, and it goes on to list the questions of the Manishtana, that's exactly what the Mishnah meant. So the Jerusalem Talmud sounds very much as though a children should be asking their own questions. The Manishtana is there as a filler text. If there are no questions, if nothing's happening at the Seder table, you can bank on these, you can pull them out and use them, but they're not part of the formal text of the Haggadah. So we have this sort of counterbalance. On the one hand, it seems to sound like the Manishtana is a formal part of the Seder. On the other hand, the Jerusalem Talmud sounds like it's not a formal part of the Seder. You could dispense with it if children are already asking questions. And this becomes a little bit of a debate. amongst the medieval scholars what exactly is the story. At the end of the day, our conclusion, which we can find here in source number 3 in terms of the halakha, seems to lean towards the Babylonian Talmud. And this is the description here in source 3. We immediately pour the second cup so that the children will ask why we are drinking a second cup before the meal. There's no intelligence in the son, quoting from the Mishnah, his father teaches him. If he has no son, his wife asks him. And if not, he asks himself. And even two scholars ask each other, Ma nishtana? This is the quote from the Babylonian Talmud. This is the notion that this is a formal text. It's part of the Haggadah. You can't escape from it. You have to say it no matter what. Okay, so that's the sort of structure. If we were wondering what exactly, where does the Manishtana lie? And I would have imagined before any of this analysis that really it's about the children. It's about children asking questions. But what we discover is that that's not true. It's really a formal part of the text of the Haggadah. You've got to say it. Even if you're alone, you need to ask Manishtana. Okay, the question then will be, why? We've explained sort of the structure. We know this is a formal part of the text. Why should this be? Why should we have to say this at every Seder? So if you would ask, if I had assumed that this was really about the children asking questions, I would have said that the purpose of the Manishtana is pedagogical. You need to, you know, there's a concept of a gripping question. I teach students at Or Chaim, and invariably, what happens every day is I have things that I prepare to teach them, I sit down, I start teaching, and they try and ask me any possible question about anything else to try and push me off topic. And often we have a fight about it, but sometimes they ask something and I see that there's a question which is really a valuable question which has gripped them, and that's a teachable moment, you can go with it. So that's what I would have said the purpose of the Manishtana was, if this was really just about children asking questions. But now that we see it's not, we have to figure out, what is it about? If this is a formal part of the text of the Haggadah, why is it there? So I wanted to suggest a possible answer. And it requires first reformatting the way we think about the question, Manishtana. We think, the way that I generally thought about it is, Manishtana is a question of facts. Why is this night different from all other nights? I want to know why it's different. But there's another potential grammatical change in terms of the Hebrew language. The question word ma can be a question of seeking information. It could be a question word. It could also be a statement of wonder. We come into shul, we say, ma tovu o halacha Yaakov. Bilam says this. He wasn't asking the question, how good are your tents? Bilam wasn't trying to quantify, are they this good? Are they this good? Maybe they're only this good. It was a statement of awe, a statement of exclamation. How amazing are these tents? And in fact, if we look in source number 4, the Aruch HaShulchan, this is exactly how he interprets the Manishtana. The meaning of Manishtana is like, how great are your acts, God? Ma gadlu ma'asecha Hashem. Again, we're not trying to figure out just how good they are. It's a statement of exclamation. How goodly are your tents, Yaakov? It's a statement of wonder. And so too here, we're filled with wonder about the great changes of this night. So I think that's the first key point that we have to make, which is a little bit of a shift. Manishtana is not a question about why this night is different, it's a statement of exclamation. How different is this night than any of the other nights of the year? The second component here is the fact that on the Seder night, we're not only required to retell a story, a dry story with facts and data and educating our children and ourselves about what happened. There's a component of lived experience. That's what we find in the last source on the page from the Mishnah. The Mishnah describes, in each and every generation, a person must view himself as though he personally left Egypt. A person has to look at themselves as though they left Egypt. And the Rambam adds, makes a couple of key changes there, but he also adds the words now. You have to view yourself right now as if you personally left Egypt. It has to be a lived experience. We start with a description of a story. We end with a direct lived experience of having left Egypt. How are you supposed to accomplish that? So I think part of the recognition, and this is the key point here, part of the recognition at the Seder is that the night of leaving, the night of the Exodus, which the Torah calls Leil Shimurim, a special night, that night never ended. It continues on a year-to-year basis. The night of the Seder is a special night. It's not like the other nights of the year. We have to recognize that our day-to-day lives have been disrupted, that something changed, that there's some kind of opportunity which is hanging in the air, which we could grasp, to feel a personal sense of redemption. And this perhaps is the point. We say manishtana, it's a statement of exclamation. It's a recognition that something is going on. Something is different on this night than on all the other nights of the year. That's what the manishtana is about. And coming full circle back to our question, why does it have to be part of every single Seder? We have to try and get our kids to ask questions, but we have to ourselves ask questions, is because we need to re-stimulate every single year, year after year, this sense of wonder. Something has changed. Something about this night is not like the other nights of the year. Manishtana. It's different. How amazing is it? And only once we start with that recognition that there's some sort of special opportunity which is available that night, can we move to have a feeling of a palpable experience of change, of some sort of redemption that's happening to us at the night of the Seder. So that's some thoughts about the Manishtana. Thank you.
Okay, so most of the sources on my page, which is this one with the diagram, I'm not going to read. I gave you this for reading material. Gloria will know that some of these are familiar. But I figured if I want to give you something for the Seder that you can easily use, a graphic is better than sources. So I gave you sources to sort of back up the point, but the main point will be summarized in this graphic right here. So how many makot were there? I know my kids like singing all different songs, and whatever the different songs are, they all come back to the basic notion that 10 makot, makot 10, right? Something like that. And that's how we always learn it. But the truth is that even when you read our Haggadah doesn't assume there are 10. And sometimes we talk about 10, and then elsewhere we talk about 50, and 200, and 250. And there's a recognition that the number 10 is somewhat arbitrary. Right? 10 assumes that we start at dam, we start at blood, and we end at makat becharot, we end with the death of the firstborns, and we count each of the makot as we do as one. But there are things that happen after the death of the firstborn, most notably the splitting of the sea and the entire catastrophe that happens to the Egyptians there. And there are things which happen before the Makot. For example, in the wonderful cinematic moment when Moshe comes in to Pharaoh and he turns his staff into a snake. Right? So there are things that happen before our start of the Makot, and there are things that happen after the end of our 10. Now this leads many commentaries from the medieval period, well, truth is even from the Midrashim that we quote in the Haggadah, but even more so in the medieval period and then in the modern period, to challenge 10 as the only way of counting and categorizing the Makot. So what I want to do today is suggest one of the many other theories, and that is presented by members of a Italian Maschilic Beit Midrash, particularly three scholars, Rav Naftali Hertz Wesley, Rav Reggio, and Shadal. And though it is sort of anticipated by Yosef Ibn Kaspi in a modified form, and that is the theory that there are 12 makot divided into four triads. Now the 12 makot, according to this theory, are the 10 that we know of, plus, on the beginning end, that moment of the transformation of the staff into the snake, and on the end, the splitting of the sea. Now, these different divisions sound almost, right? It sounds semantic. Okay, these are the 10 plagues, the 12 plagues, there was a miracle before the plagues, there's a miracle after the plagues. Who really cares where we count the miracles? Where we count the plagues. But the reason that so much ink was spilled trying to define how many plagues there were and categorizing them is that patterns emerge depending on how you count them. So I want to try to present their theory. So if we just look at the graphic I put here, the first triad, as he suggests it, is the staff turning into the snake, the blood, and the frogs. The second is lice, wild animals, the death of the animals. The third is boiled hails and locusts. And the fourth is darkness, the death of the firstborns, and the splitting of the sea. But Wesley and Reggio and Shadal argue that if you follow this triad theory, you actually see fascinating things. So, the first thing that he notes, and this is actually not noted by him, this is noted by Philo, so thousands of years ago, is that God, when he wanted to conquer the Egyptians, part of his method, part of his goal, was to prove that he controlled all of nature, and therefore he was the true God, as opposed to all the gods in their pantheon. In order to do that, he needed to attack the Egyptians at every realm of experience. And the four classic realms of experience that the ancients believed in were water, land, air, and heaven. So Wesley notes that if you look, once you take the four triad theory, the first three take place by the water, right? The snake is sort of a sea creature, especially in Egypt. It's the symbol of the sea. And then the blood and the frogs actually take place in the water. Then you have lice, wild animals, and animals which happen on the level of land. And then the boils, which happen because Moshe throws the ashes into the air. And then hail, which comes out of heaven, and the locusts, which come from a wind, take place on the level of air. And then darkness, which actually darkens the heavens. The death of the firstborns, which is the angel slash God coming out of heaven to kill the firstborns. And then the splitting of the sea, which is again God's coming down with his fire and his wind from heaven to split the sea, is at the level of heaven. So one thing you see from the triad theory is this notion that God is trying to attack the Egyptians at every plane of existence. Another thing that he notes, which is fascinating, is that one of the goals of the plagues was to persuade the Egyptians that their gods and the representatives of their gods, namely the magicians, the priests and magicians, are nothing compared to God. And he notes that if you follow this triad theory, you see the progression of God's victory over these representative of the gods. In the first three makot, if you count this way, what can the Egyptian priests, magicians do? I take the scene of the snake. They can replicate it. They can't perfectly replicate it. Moshe and Aaron are still a little bit ahead of them because Aaron's staff swallows the staffs of the Egyptian magicians, but it can be replicated and God is just one step ahead of them. Starting in the second triad, it starts with lice, where the magicians are not able to do it. So what do they say? Etzba Elohim hi. They recognize that it's something they can't do, and therefore they must be dealing with a god. By boils, which is the beginning of the third triad, the psukim describe that they can no longer stand. They're in so much pain from the boils, the magicians can't stand. So it's not only they can't replicate it, but they are physically being attacked by this god. And then by time you get to darkness, it's just Pharaoh. There is no discussion of his advisors, of his magicians anymore, because they've been so cowed into submission, they're irrelevant. So he notes that if one of the point of the plagues is to educate the Egyptians that their forces and powers and gods and magicians are meaningless, so the four triad theory helps us see the progression. First you one-up them, then you do something they can't do, then you attack them, and then you make them disappear in their irrelevance. And therefore Wesley and Shadal and Reggio go through this, and they suggest that by reorganizing, recognizing, and what I think the main thing for us to take out of this is that, I still have 2 minutes, is that the story of the Mako doesn't start with Dam and end with Makat Bechorot. There are other elements to the story which, while we may not focus on them in our Haggadahs, they're part of the story and they lend insight to the goals of God in this process. And by including those stories, both the Tanin, the snake, and the splitting of the sea, and recognizing that patterns emerge as you broaden the story, it helps us get a better perspective of the Makot and the purpose of the Makot. I'm not going to go through any more, but in number two, I just give you a link. My new source for this year for finding insights for the Haggadah is an excellent, excellent website called alhatorah.org. The link is right there, where they have pre-made shiurim on many things through Tanakh with sources and summaries, which is where I found these sources. So I gave you a link to it, and you'll see I also copied part of that unit where you can see some of the other insights that they derive from this four triad theory, including why certain Makot get warnings before them, why certain Makot do not get warnings before them. I gave that to you there, but like I said, I think the main thing that we can see from this categorization is that if we want to fully understand the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim, it's helpful to remember that there were things that happened before and after the 10 Makot we focus on, and when you take the broader perspective, patterns emerge that help us understand God's goals in the educating of the Egyptians in the Yetziat Mitzrayim story. That was exactly 10 minutes, okay? I promise you.
Hi, everyone. I have sheets here if they're interested. I don't think I printed out enough. So what I'll do is I'll summarize given the 10 minutes that I have. So I have Shvoch HaMascha. I think a good way to introduce this topic is from a conversation actually that we had at breakfast. And I'll go out on a limb here and I'll test myself to see if I understand the dispositions of the shear here. Okay, so imagine this. We're going to have a thought experiment. You need a car. You're in need of a car, and you found two cars at a great price, and they give you everything you're looking for. And it's really a decision between these two cars, okay? There's only one difference between them. Okay, one is a Volkswagen, one is a German car, and the other is some other car. Doesn't matter. Which one are you more likely to choose? Will that affect your choice as to which car you'll buy? They're exactly the same, but you know that one was made in Germany. Yeah, can I get anything? Like, no, it doesn't make a difference. It does. It does make a difference. Okay. So I think this sense, we don't need to necessarily explore this feeling, but this sense is really articulated in Shvos HaMascha, in pouring out your wrath in a very healthy way. And let me explain. If you Google it online, you'll find a lot of articles that advocate removing it from the Haggadah, because it talks about anger, it talks about hate, and we don't want to teach our children hate, and we don't want to be a part of invoking God to behave in a very hateful or angry way. So within the few minutes that I have, I'm going to try to mount a defense to keep Shvos HaMascha in the Haggadah and to highlight some significance, some profound significance to it. So let's just read it in English, just to have it. If we can have a dramatic actor here, John Lithgow, that would be great. But all you have is me. So I'm going to read it in English, and we're going to see how severe it is. Pour your wrath upon the nations that did not know you, and upon the kingdoms that did not call upon your name, since they have consumed Jacob and laid waste to his inhabitation. Pour out your fury upon them, and the fierceness of your anger shall reach them. You shall pursue them with anger and eradicate them from under the skies of the Lord. Right? It's very dramatic. It's very serious. We can kind of see and understand why some people might feel a bit uncomfortable with saying this in the Haggadah. So I want to bring two approaches. I'll summarize them for you briefly. These are Chazal's approaches towards anger, towards what it means to have kas, or to what it means to have frustration or anger. I'm assuming chama or chamascha and kaascha are interchangeable in this case. The first is the Gemara from Sanhedrin, which brings a very famous parable that talks about the cloud that separated the camp of the Jewish people from the camp of the Mitzrim. And they weren't allowed to come close to one another. These two camps weren't allowed to come close. The Gemara asks why, and the Gemara tells a story. Because at that time, the Malachi Asharit, the angels, said, "We want to sing Shira to you, Hashem. We want to sing praises to you," right? And Hashem retorts, you know what the retort is, right? What's the reply? Right, "My creations are going to drown in the sea. They're drowning in the sea. And you want to sing Shira before me?" Right? So who is God addressing himself to first off? The angels, right? He's not addressing himself to Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael are allowed to sing Shira, right? And there's a screen, there's like almost literally a smoke screen between Am Yisrael and between the Mitzrim, right? Am Yisrael, their experience is redemption. And so they get to feel a sense of Hakara Satov. They get to feel a sense of triumph and a sense of joy. But the Mitzrim, whom they can't see, what are they experiencing? They're experiencing suffering. They're experiencing punishment, right? The Malachim, on the other hand, that have a bird's eye view of what's going on, they can see both. They can see everything, right? And so they don't necessarily have a right to sing Shira when they would have to compartmentalize, so to speak, the suffering of people that may not necessarily deserve it, or people who are just quote-unquote following the orders of Pharaoh. Whereas the Jewish people have a right to sing because they are just focused only on their sense of salvation, on their sense of being saved. Right, so there's a kind of compartmentalization that's going on here that the Malachim are not privy to, that we are privy to. That's the first thing. Because otherwise, if we know someone else is suffering and we're happy, that would be kind of cruel, right? That would be kind of cruel to sing at the expense of someone else, or to praise someone and to rejoice at the suffering of others. Our job is not to focus on the suffering of others. Our job is to sing Shira. Our job is to sing Hallel. That's what we're focusing on. That's what the Haggadah is trying to focus us on. Let's go to the next source. The next source is a Gemara in Shabbos. Wow, I took up 5 minutes. All right, so the Gemara in Shabbos talks about doing something in anger, like tearing your garment. It's actually a constructive act. So technically, you could be over an Isser Malacha on Shabbat if you rend your garment. Why? Because you're making yourself feel calm, right? It's like therapy. They take you to therapy and they have these like punching bags and you punch it and you feel better, right? Or just going jogging, right? That helps me sometimes when I'm frustrated. I go jogging, I calm down. So tearing your clothes is a constructive act. So you could technically be over an Isser Malacha. However, the Gemara objects and saying someone who acts in anger, someone who tears their clothes in anger, it's as if they are committing avodah zarah. Why? Why is it as if they're committing avodah zarah? Because the yetzer hara is in control of you when you have anger. You don't think with the rational part of your brain. The more primitive part of your brain, the more emotive part of your brain is activated, and you can't really control yourself. And you don't care about whether the Rabbona Shel Olam wills something differently. You just want your emotions fulfilled. You just want your ratzon done. Which is why when I clap al chetz on Yom Kippur, I can certainly say to some extent I've been over kiviyachal avodah zarah, because I know what it's like to feel angry. I felt angry before. And I know that it is condemned within Chazal, right? And the Yetzer Hara will tell me I get angry, I behave in this way. Eventually, the Avodah Zarah can control me and to actually worship Avodah Zarah Mamash, real Avodah Zarah. So Chazal themselves distance themselves from anger and from cruelty. And yet, nevertheless, we say Shvoch Chamascha, right? So is there a proper way to, or a constructive way to channel our anger? And with this, I'd like to read an extract from a historian, a Holocaust historian who combats Holocaust deniers. Her name is Deborah E. Lipstadt, and she says the following, for those of you who don't have the sources. Many Seder participants are decidedly uncomfortable with this short paragraph, which asks that God's wrath be poured out on the nations that do not call out in God's name. Some modern Haggadot delete this paragraph, finding it too pregnant with vengeance and revenge. Defying the Seder's universal themes of freedom and liberation, it made their compilers uncomfortable. I, on the other hand, love it. Why my infatuation with this hard-hitting paragraph? I picture the many beleaguered Jews, particularly in Europe, for whom Passover, with its proximity to Easter, was a dangerous time. I imagine Jews who spent much of the year fearful that the non-Jewish world might violently turn on them. They knew they would have little recourse to protect themselves. Suddenly, for one short paragraph, they opened the door of their homes. Of course, most of their non-Jewish neighbors had by then retired for the night, and publicly told the world that what they wished for those who had done them evil. For one brief moment, they could let their desire for justice be heard publicly. They did not have to cower in fear. And yet they did not ask God to let them pour out their own wrath. This is the important diuk inference that she's making. Even now, when Jewish machismo has briefly appeared, they ask God to render judgment and to punish only those who did not call out in God's name. That is, those nations that failed to adhere to ethical standards. For one brief shining moment, the Jew stood tall. The playing field was more than equal as the Jew turned to the judge of all the world, the same judge Abraham challenged in Genesis, and called upon that judge to do justice. And then, as suddenly as it began, it ended. The door was shut, the Jew sat down, the Seder continued, and all returned as it had been and would remain for too many years. Right. So this historian of the Holocaust is really aware that we've experienced a lot of suffering. And when someone causes you suffering or someone causes you harm, it's a natural consequence to get angry and to feel upset. And those emotions need to be validated. It doesn't mean that they need to be approved of, but they need to be validated and channeled in an appropriate way from a cultural consciousness perspective. And we're not asking that we get to take out our vengeance. We're asking God to take out what we would believe would be vengeance before Him. But let's also note, because it's very brief, where it's found in the Haggadah. Where Shvuah HaMatra is actually found also provides us with some context. It's found right after we welcome Eliyahu Hanavi into our homes. Eliyahu Hanavi was very zealous. He could be very angry as well. And there's a Aruch HaShulchan that says Eliyahu got so upset when the Bris Milah, we also welcome him at Bris Milah, another life cycle event. He got so upset that at one point Bris Milah was outlawed that Hashem had to kind of wager a bet with him saying, you're going to see that the Jewish people will be okay and that they're going to continue to do Bris Milah. Which is why we have a Kisei Eliyahu. We invite Eliyahu in for every Bris Milah. Because Eliyahu was so upset that we weren't behaving appropriately that Hashem had to tell him, according to Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, that there's going to be a special place for you at every Bris in the future so you see that we still keep our loyalty to the Rabbona Shalom, that the Jewish people still keep the covenant of Abraham by performing a Bris. And it was at that time in Tanakh when Eliyahu said, this is too much, everyone is gone, I am here for you. When Hashem said, I need to appoint for you, you need to appoint a new leader. You need to appoint Elisha to serve under you. Because Eliyahu, in his righteous anger and his righteous rage, removed himself from the ability to continue to serve leading Israel. Let's build this parallel with Am Yisrael. What are we supposed to be? We're supposed to be a light unto the nations, right? And if we get so upset with the rest of the world, we could remove ourselves from our national goal and fulfilling our national destiny of relating to the world and being an Or LaGoyim. So we invite Eliyahu in first, because we can identify with his frustration, but we also know that there's a danger towards being angry, and there's a danger towards our own righteous rage, and it may undermine our very purpose of being an Am Segula V'Goy Kadosh. And so we have Eliyahu with us when we make this plea to Hashem. And finally, after we say Shvos Chamaska, we say Hallel. We praise Hashem, and we begin the Hallel with Lo Lanu Hashem, Lo Lanu Ki Lashim Chatein Kavod. Not us, but rather in your name give glory. This isn't only about our freedom. It's not only about how righteous we are. It's primarily about our goal in relating and bringing God into this world. And if we can channel our anger in that way, if only for a moment, then we can validate our feelings, and then we can grow in this experiential Seder together. We do it intellectually. We even poke the Tam and the Eino Yodea Lishol, the one who can't ask, to give them intellectual scaffolding. Shvo Chamascha gives us emotional scaffolding as well, which is why it's very important, or I'm arguing it's a very important part of the Seder. So I hope this brought a little bit of nuance to this short, intense paragraph. Thank you very much.
And wrapping up the four for tonight, I really want to thank Rabbi Shor for speaking, not only for the beautiful thought and insight into Shvo Chamascha, but also for the fact that he was really a last-minute substitute because the conflict came up for Rabbi Strauchler, and Rabbi Shor pitched in, and thank you for doing so. So my topic is actually, and if you have the source sheets, you can see it, the song of Va'amartem Zevach Pesach. Va'amartem Zevach Pesach is only sung outside of Israel. It's only sung at a second Seder, and it's at the end of the second Seder. So by this point, you need a good story if you're going to say anything that anyone wants to listen to, because they're ready. They're done. They're looking at next year. They've counted the Omer. They're in. So I heard the following story told about a Hasidish Rebbe. It was a speaker several months ago. I don't remember who the speaker was. I've been hunting for this story to see if it's really true, because it's a great story. And unfortunately, I haven't found the source. It's still a great story, and I'm still going to tell it. I believe he told it about the Kutzker, and all great Hasidish stories are told about the Kutzker, whether they're actually about him or not. So the story goes that the Kutzker said, "When Mashiach comes, I'm not going to go see him." Day one, day two, a week's going to go by, 2 weeks are going to go by, 3 weeks are going to go by, I'm not going to go see him. Eventually, when it fits into my schedule, I'm going to go see Mashiach. And Mashiach's going to turn to me and say, "Mendel, where you been? I've been waiting for you." And I'm going to say to him, "A chutzpah! You've been waiting for me? You're telling me you're waiting for me? Where have you been?" That's his story, which it's a great story. It should be true. But the truth of the matter is that this story has a precedent in Tanakh. And it's the story of Gidon. It's found in the book of Shoftim, and it's referenced in the song, Va'amartem Zevach Pesach. Va'amartem Zevach Pesach is a song which speaks of events which occur on Pesach night. And this story in particular, which is referenced in just one line, holds significant lessons for us, not really chidushim, not novel ideas, but I think important ideas regarding miracles and their purpose and regarding our goal at the Seder. So let me take you back to the story of Gidon. It's referenced here in this one line, which I brought you on the sheets in number one. Nishmeda Midyan betzlil se'orei Omer Pesach. Midyan was destroyed with a cake of Omer barley on Pesach. That's a little cryptic, right? What are you talking about? So here's what we're talking about. Gidon's story takes place about 200 years after the Jews leave Mitzrayim, after the Jews leave Egypt. They're now living in Israel. It's the period of the Shoftim, of the judges. They are oppressed by Midianite raiders. Midian lives east of the Yarden, and they launch attacks from there periodically to take the crops of the Jews by force. So our story opens with Gidon threshing grain in a wine press to avoid detection by the Midianites. And a malach, an angel, comes to visit Gidon and says to him, as you see in source number 2 on your sheets, Hashem imcha gibor hachayil. God is with you, mighty warrior. Now, you're in this wine press threshing the grain, and an angel appears to you, right? Even if you're not sure if it's an angel, it's a prophet, you can tell there's something special. And he says to you, God is with you, mighty warrior. So I might be a little intimidated by that. I might be a little encouraged by that. Oh, something's different now. Maybe things are going to change. Not Gidon. Look at Gidon's response, and it's echoes of this Chassidish Rebbe in the story. Vayomer elav Gidon. Gidon said, "Be Adoni, please, my master. V'yesh Hashem imanu." Is God really with us? Is that true? V'lama mitzahasnu kol zos. So tell me, why has all of this happened to us? Why are we living under Midian? Where are all those wonders our ancestors told us about? You tell me 2 centuries ago God took us up out of Egypt. And God's abandoned us now. He gave us into the hands of Midian. It's a powerful response from Gidon to this angel, which probably doesn't know what hit him. This event occurs, according to a medrash cited in Rashi, and it fits elements of the story, this event occurs on Pesach itself. I brought you the Rashi in source number 3. In the interest of time, I'm not going to read it out loud. But this is Pesach time, and actually the grain that he has is associated with the Omer offering, which is brought on the second day of Pesach, but I'm also not going to discuss the Omer right now because this is a 10-minute Dvar Torah. So, Gidon does not trust God. But God does not respond with anger. Instead, Hashem says to him, "Lech b'chochacha zeh." With that fire that you have, with that energy that you have, I want you to go lead the Jews in battle against Midian. But Gideon's not ready. Gideon says, "Wait, I want a miracle. I want a sign. I want something that shows that you're really going to be with me." And God complies. And if you see on your sheet, I gave you the chain of miracles in number 4. God sends a fire that consumes an offering from Gidon. And at that point, God says, "Okay, your turn, Gidon. Your father is the head of the local Avodah Zarah, the local idolatry. Destroy his Mizbeach and destroy his idols." Shades of the story of Abraham. There's a lot there to parallel Gidon and Abraham. Also Gidon and Moshe, that's another discussion. So, one miracle, and then Gidon does what he's supposed to do. Next phase. God says, "Okay, you're going to rally your forces against Midian. Here's another miracle." Gideon asked for another sign. And to make a long story short, there is a threshing floor. There's a piece of wool that Gideon puts in the middle of the floor. And Gideon says, "God, I want you to set things up so that the wool is wet and the threshing floor is dry." God says, "Done." And it happens. And Gideon says, "You know what? Not that. That's too easy. Flip it. I want you to make the wool dry and everything else wet, so the wool doesn't absorb the moisture." God says, "Okay." And God does that. And Gideon's really impressed. And then he does the next thing he's supposed to do, which is he cuts down his army of many thousands of people to just 300 to fight against mighty Midian. Then Gideon's about to go to war, and God says, "I'll give you another sign." And he says, "Gideon, you go with your assistant down into the camp of Midian and just listen." And he listens, he eavesdrops at the camp, and he hears one guard saying to another that he had a terrible nightmare, presumably not while he was on guard duty, but he had a terrible nightmare. He envisioned a barley cake rolling over their tent, and the other guard says, "That's Gidon." And that's what you're hearing referenced in the song, is the vision of this barley cake, which they interpret to mean Gidon destroying Midian, and then Gidon is so excited he goes to war, and sure enough, they rout Midian. Now, understanding the story, you see what happens here, just to get the story straight. Every time Hashem wants something supernatural from Gidon, and he wants Gidon to do something that people don't normally do, destroy your father's idols, reduce the size of your army, go to war against Midian, Hashem is willing to send him a sign first. But you have to ask a question here. Why wasn't the first sign good enough? Why wasn't the second sign good enough? Why is it that every step of the way he needs reinforcement, doesn't he already know what God can do? Rav Sadia Gaon, and I brought you the quote in source number 5, explains, there's nothing wrong with what Gidon is doing. There are 2 different ways to test God, so to speak. One is prohibited, the other one is not. What's prohibited for a Jew, there's a law, lo tenasu et Hashem, you can't test God, is to say, "I don't think God has power. I want God to prove what he can do." That's not a good idea. However, it's legitimate for a Jew to say, "I want to know God is with me. I want to breathe. I want a covenant with God, that God is going to care about me and act for me. I know there's a creator, and I know the creator is powerful, but how do I know that he cares about me, is going to do anything?" That's what bothered Gidon from the outset. He said, "I believe that all that happened way back when, but what does it have to do with me?" And that's what Gideon wants. He wants to know that Hashem is not going to drop him. That Hashem is going to actually carry him the entire way, deploy that power for him. There's a similar idea in Ibn Ezra, in Bereishis, on Avraham, when Avraham asks for a sign as well. So we see that in Gideon's speech, when he says, God has abandoned us. And that's why the first miracles wear off. He doesn't trust that it's going to continue. Think of the Jews at the golden calf. Same idea. How is it that you build this new god of sorts so soon after you received the Torah, you saw all those miracles and the makos and the sea and everything else? And the answer is because, yes, we believe God has power, but we think he abandoned us here because it's been 6 weeks and we haven't seen Moshe. It's the sense of, I need an association with God. And that brings us back to our Seder. Our Seder is not about acknowledging divine power. If that were true, then we should respond just like Gideon and say, who cares if there is a powerful creator if I'm still suffering? The Hasidic Rebbe is right about Mashiach. How could he keep us waiting like this? The power is irrelevant if it doesn't lead to Geula, if it doesn't lead to redemption. And Pesach is meant, and our Seder is meant, to orient us toward the belief that God is going to help us. On Pesach we say, Chayav Adam Liros es Atzmo ki ilu hu yatza mimitzrayim. You're supposed to see yourself as though you left Egypt. That God was actually acting on your behalf. So you can actually stick this in earlier in the Seder. If you don't want to wait for Avar Martim Lezav Pesach, you can stick it in on that line. And that's good also in Israel, where no one's singing Avar Martim Lezav Pesach anyway. On Pesach we say, Ba'avur ze asa Hashem li b'tzeisi mimitzrayim. For this purpose, God acted on my behalf when I left Egypt. The emphasis is not asa Hashem, that God did. The emphasis is asa Hashem li, that God did for me. Pesach does not proclaim there is a God in the world. That's Rosh Hashanah's job. Pesach proclaims there is a relationship with God in this world. That's what we're supposed to emerge with. So as we say, Ba'avur ze asa Hashem li, that for this God acted for me, let's think about Gideon and his anger and the miracles that Hashem sent him in response. And may we also see the day when it's not only history, something that we have from Gideon's time and the other events of Martim Zevach Pesach, but with our own eyes, we will also truly see Ba'avur ze asa Hashem li, that God has acted for us. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming to tonight. I know we had a lot of competition. I hope people donated to Chai Lifeline. And I hope people also are seeing Nefesh B'Nefesh, just not during our program. And once again, thank you very much. And if you didn't sign in, please make sure to sign in. And then you'll get the link with the audios, not only from tonight, but also from last night as well. Have a great night and Chag Kasher V'Sameach.